Back with you to wrap up a very busy week heading into the Labor Day weekend, Friday, September 3rd, 2021, on Connecticut Today. Criminal justice expert William Carbone from the University of New Haven stopped by to talk about the latest efforts in fine-tuning Connecticut's juvenile justice system. Professor Nelson Alio joined us from Quinnipiac University on the disappointing job numbers for August that were released a few hours before showtime. And to start off the show, I had a few thoughts about whether or not Joe Biden is just too old to be president. So I stumbled on a story yesterday and I did a lot of cross-checking to see, well, is this just one outlet running this story? And no, it went to a couple of other outlets and it seems that the story has veracity and is true. Now, reading this story and going over it a couple of times in my head led me to ask this question. Is the White House press corps doing its job? Very simple. Is the White House press corps doing its job? And what I mean by doing its job, much the way there were accusations or rumblings in the previous administration that, you know, what was the mental state of President Trump at the time? Is the job too much for him? You know, he's in his 70s, this, that, and the other. There was a lot of buzz that something must have physically been wrong with him because his hand was shaking once when he, I think, drank some water, or he had a tough time walking down an incline once. And I was like, well, okay, that's fine. You know, listen, you want the president of the United States, the ostensibly the leader of the free world, to be okay, all right? You want the guy and eventually the gal to be okay. But you notice there's very little, if any, talk about something, folks, that's staring us right in the face. Joe Biden's growing more feeble. I know it. You know it. The White House press corps knows it, and I'm sure there's rumbling and whispering in the press corps, but nobody is going there yet. Because once you, if you're a member of the press corps and you bring this up during a news conference, two things happen. Number one, you've just gone there, meaning, okay, now somebody is questioning it. And number two, if you do question the physical or mental stability of a president, okay, then you may end up, you or your organization, you may end up on the you-know-what list in the White House press office. Oh, they have a list. And as far as then accessing the president or accessing administration people for your Sunday show, forget it. Now, why am I bringing this up? Let's get back to the original point here. Why am I bringing this up? This story, this version in the Washington Times, it's in a couple of local Pittsburgh outlets. It's also on Newsweek.com. Yes, Newsweek still exists. President Biden said Thursday that he had visited the Pittsburgh synagogue where 11 worshipers were killed by a white supremacist gunman. The Tree of Life synagogue says he didn't. Mr. Biden made the claim in a 16-minute speech to Jewish leaders to mark the coming high holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. In the teleconference address, Mr. Biden said, quote, I remember spending time at the, you know, going to the, you know, the Tree of Life synagogue, speaking with them. But the synagogue's executive director told the New York Post that Mr. Biden has never been to the synagogue since the October 2018 mass killings. The Post said she firmly replied no, quote unquote, when asked whether Mr. Biden has visited since the anti-Semitic attack. Then President Trump and several top Jewish advisors, including his daughter Ivanka Trump, son-in-law Jared Kushner, and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, visited the synagogue 3 days after the deadliest single attack on Jews in U.S. history. The White House did not immediately respond to the New York Post's request for comment. try to find this story. Now, maybe it popped up since I checked a few hours ago. I dare you. And maybe you can tell me that it has. Try to find this story on ABC, on NBC, on CBS, on PBS, on MSNBC, on CNN. They have a sitting president of the United States in a 16-minute teleconference who says he was somewhere and spoke with all these people when he wasn't. Now, there are some people trying to cover for this, and, well, you know, so many of these things happen. And I'm sure he sent out a statement of condolence and this, that, and the other. And, a guy like him is so busy during his campaign. Oh, come on, stop. And here's my point. And if you have a feeling on this, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Can you imagine if the parties were reversed here? Can you imagine if it was a Republican president still in office, Donald Trump or somebody, who said, yeah, well, you know, I visited the Tree of Life synagogue and I met with all those people who were just shocked and stunned. And somebody called the synagogue and said, did he visit? And they said, no. Can you imagine? This would be what we call in the business an A segment or near the top story on every newscast. But there is, folks, I'm telling you, there is a cone of silence, or a code, whatever, of silence around this whole thing. The president, look, he's the leader of the free world, I get it. He looked and sounded awful during the speech on Afghanistan that we carried live here on WICC the other day. Listen to him when he speaks and watch him. The face is expressionless. The eyes are squinting at the teleprompter, and he's slurring words. I'm not saying he's got to be replaced. I'm not saying the 25th Amendment should be brought into suggestion here, as it was numerous times with President Trump. But why is no one talking about this? And it's okay, Mr. Biden, it's okay to get old. It's okay. We all, hopefully, are going to live to ripe old ages. He's going to be 79 in November, this coming November 20th, I think is his birthday. He's going to be 79. Okay? Why is no one talking about this? All right, we'll be back to open phones a little bit later on in the hour. News once again, top of the hour at 4, less than 5 minutes away from another check of traffic and weather together as the storm cleans up right here. But we switch back to a topic that fascinates me, and I'm trying to give you as broad of a scope of guests on this as I can. Our next guest is an expert on juvenile justice reform and reducing offender recidivism in the probation population. During a tenure as executive director of the Court Support Services Division of the state's judicial branch, he led a multi-year effort to reform the state's juvenile justice system, leading the state to achieving the greatest reduction in juvenile incarceration in the entire U.S. He's currently a senior lecturer and director of experiential education at the Toe Youth Justice Institute at the University of New Haven, and joining us right now for a few minutes on WICC, William Carbone. William, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
I'm very good this afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, and thanks for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it. What is your look at some of these announced changes that did not have to go through the legislature per se that we saw a couple of days ago on giving what many police chiefs said they wanted, in other words, and others have, better access, for example, to some criminal records so they know how to better handle some of these juveniles that are arrested?
Oh, I think that was a step in the right direction, and hats off to the judicial branch in the state of Connecticut for coming forward and getting that new policy in place as quickly as they have. And now when police chiefs encounter a juvenile and they have to make a decision as to whether or not they seek a court order of detention, they can make that decision more thoughtfully, as they will have full consideration of that juvenile's record. And so I think this will go a long way toward assisting the police in making these important decisions that they must make.
And obviously, Professor, that I mean, that's a key point there, because letting somebody out, I would think, letting someone or just have minimal contact released to the parents or whatever, and not fully knowing what an individual has gone through in the past, you know, in times could be an aid to keeping them down a course that we want to get them off of.
Yeah, but, you know, I think you have to look at the increased information that they will have at their disposal both ways. Yes, it might, in fact, for some kids, lead them to believe that there's a threat to the public for which they should seek an order to detain. On the other hand, the record might also reveal that the child or family is in critical need of support services that happen to be available in that community, so a referral to services might be a better option.
Yeah, let's take a break here. I want to come back and talk a little more, Professor, about the family experience here and what might be driving some of this and what you have found out in your years of experience. Hang on, we'll be right back with you. William Carbone is the guest, senior lecturer and director of experiential education at the Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice and Forensic Sciences at the University of New Haven. More with him straight ahead. Traffic and weather together, 3:36 on WICC. A few more minutes with our guest, an expert on juvenile justice reform and reducing offender recidivism in the probation population. He's a senior lecturer at the University of New Haven's Henry C. Lee of College of Criminal Justice and Forensic Sciences, directs the Experiential Education Department there. William Carbone continues with us. William, over your years of experience, what are the one or two biggest things that you have found that prevent or slow down recidivism and kind of break the cycle? Are there one or two things that are points A and B into trying to do this?
Well, I think one of the factors that leads to crime among kids is, of course, school failure. So options that are designed to reconnect kids with schools, to give them the kind of help they need to improve their academic record, are very important. The more you keep a child in school, the less likely you're going to see them in the juvenile justice system. The second thing that I would say to you clearly has to do with family functionality. When you look at the clinical histories of children in the system, you can, more often than not, you can find a family that is at risk, where you have abuse, neglect, abandonment, parents that themselves are involved in the justice system, perhaps parents that are involved with substance abuse issues. So this has profound, profound influence on the home life and the modeling for children. And children during this time are very, very impressionable. I often say to my students, they're like sponges. They're constantly absorbing what is happening around them. And that's both positive qualities as well as negative qualities.
So, William, does this kind of lead to what we have heard and folks like me who are brutally uneducated in this sort of stuff, but you read about, for some of these offenders, the local gang or the street gang or the local neighborhood kids, that being the kind of unit that they want to gravitate to because there's nothing there or not enough there with their family? Is that what we're looking at?
Yeah, I think that's certainly reasonable. And frankly, what happens is kids do want family. Kids do want to be validated. They do want to be accepted. They want some regulation. When they don't find it in their home, and in particular when you have kids who are failing in school, they want to stop going to school because school becomes a very negative experience for them. So they don't go. And when they don't go, they hang around with other kids who are similarly situated. And that's really how the notion of a gang begins, because they're young kids, they're adolescents, the hormones are pumping, and they're looking for adventurous things to do. And when they're out of school, that's what's happening. And so you can see how that might lead to criminal groups or gangs.
And is that what we get, William, when police say they know some of these offenders or they know some of these gangs and maybe these initiations or, as you say, these daring things to do sometimes involve crime, whether it's, what, carjacking, stealing cars or things like that?
Yeah, and I think this is where citizens have a responsibility, too, because so many of the car theft matters, even in our own state of Connecticut, result from individuals that simply don't lock their cars. And they've made it actually much easier for kids to commit these crimes. But let me just say, car thefts and car-related offenses are substantially down from what they were in past years. And even though in 2019 and in 2020 we had slight increases in those offenses, our increase was far, far less than the rest of the country, and certainly were nowhere near the heights that we were at 10, 20 years ago. So it is, when it happens, of course, it gets a lot of attention, but I don't think we can generalize that we have a car theft problem in the state of Connecticut.
What about, by the way, the guest is William Carbone from the University of New Haven. William, what about and hopefully with these changes now that we talked about, this will be less of a problem, but the public, understandably, William, has a lot of questions when they see or at least hear about some of the particulars of some of these offenders, particularly like the kid in New Britain and others. And the public says, wow, 12 or 13 arrests in 2 or 3 years. You know, what's going on with that? We don't want to put a kid in jail who steals a candy bar. But on the other end of the spectrum, they are duly concerned. How would you explain? How does that happen, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, and they have every right to be concerned. And the important thing is not to overreact to a single case or believe that a single case should drive new legislation that would affect all kids, because the vast preponderance of kids that come into the system do not come back. Or if they come back once or twice, we don't see them again. I mean, there are some kids like the one you mentioned that have considerable numbers, but they are not the rule. They are truly the exception. So the more education of the public that we can do to actually tell them juvenile crime has come down 50% from what it was just in 2010. And that's, by the way, after we incorporated 16 and 17-year-olds into the system in 2010 and in 2012. So we put two huge age groups that were previously considered adults under Connecticut law, put them into the juvenile system, and we still have a 50% reduction in crime. So overall, the juvenile system is functioning quite well. And truly, there's many other states who, when they want to talk about how to improve their systems, they come to Connecticut.
What is the next major step that you folks who deal with this on a daily basis want to take in this?
Well, I think there's several things that we want to try to address. Number one is the deeper that you get into the system, the more disproportionately minority it is. And there's some basic issues of fairness there that I think need to be addressed. And we need to make every effort to try to reduce that kind of a racial disparity that we see in our system. A second one clearly is working more effectively with the schools so that we can begin to address the problem of academic failure. It will, in so many of these cases, be the first indication that this is a child that's potentially coming into the system in the future. And boy, that has to be done in the lower grades in our state. A third one clearly is a recognition that so many of these kids now, due to the trauma that they have experienced in their young lives, have developed some significant mental health problems. There needs to be easier ways for these types of kids to access the community mental health system. They should not have to come into the juvenile justice system in order to get help. for depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, or whatever it is that they are experiencing. So we have many, many challenges ahead of us, but we shouldn't let that in any way mask the progress that the state has made to have a fairer, more just, and more decent juvenile justice system.
William Carbone, senior lecturer, director of experiential education at the Toe Youth Justice Institute, Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice and Forensic Sciences at the University of New Haven. William, thank you for the time. We appreciate it. Hope to hook up in the future and have a nice weekend. Thank you.
Okay, you too. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right, there you go. William Carbone. Speaking of numbers, job numbers, not at all what the so-called experts had predicted. The August job numbers are out. The estimate about 600,000 going in. Private payrolls increasing by just 374,000 before they're adjusted. What does it all mean? Is it all COVID? Is it partly COVID? Is it a true indicator of what's going on? To talk about that, Quinnipiac University Professor Nelson Alino joins us. He's the Interim Associate Dean of the School of Business at Quinnipiac. He's also a professor of accounting. Professor, good afternoon. Paul Pacelli here. How are you, sir?
Good afternoon, Paul. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. Well, Professor, the numbers, a lot of the experts say disappointing. I get that. But is this, Professor, in your mind, any reason for long-term concern, or is this all still about the pandemic?
I tend to agree with you, seeing this as we're panicking, right? And rightly so. I think it's just purely COVID. And I did say this a couple of weeks back when we're all excited about the all signs showing we need employees here, job offers, open spaces.
Yeah.
And I did tell people that, with all that government is giving at the time, right, it's right for people to stay at home and not go to work. But if you look at it, on the overall terms, you will see that the possibilities are there. I keep going back to the fundamentals, mm-hmm. are still strong, and I want to be cautious about it, but I think the fundamentals are still strong. Once there's a clear picture as to where we're going, things are going to bounce back. But with the presence of the Delta variant of the COVID, we don't expect anything different. I think it's going to be up and down until things stabilize.
All right, Professor, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Got to take a quick break here. More straight ahead with Quinnipiac University Professor Nelson Alino on these job numbers. He says the fundamentals are there. When we come back, we'll ask the professor about these extra benefits, which I guess are ending in a few days next week. What effect might that have? Traffic and weather together. More on the job numbers coming up on WICC. And we're talking about the job numbers that came out for August that were released earlier today. The experts had projected about 600,000 private sector non-farm jobs, falling way short, about 340,000 or so. Talking about this with us is Quinnipiac University Professor Nelson Alino. He's the Interim Associate Dean of the School of Business at Quinnipiac. He's also a professor of accounting. Professor, the extra federal benefits for unemployment, how much of a factor do you think this was in these lower job numbers? I was out the other night, Professor, and I went to get some fast food. And for the first time, Professor, in North Haven, I saw a sign that said, dining room closed due to labor shortage, drive through only. And that was the first time I saw that. Is this a problem?
This actually is just the problem across the service industry as it stands like this. I went to my mechanic. I had to do a job, and I was given 2 weeks to come back.
Wow.
Because they don't have enough people to go in there to help. And I think when this ends, the question is whether this is going to help the employment numbers, right? If that is the question, I will still say, let's hope that the Delta variant or whatever variant of the COVID is going to come through during the winter season is not going to have a negative effect. And of course, like I said, the fundamentals are strong. we're still going to have to go out and get something, and that was evident this past few months. Again, it's a function of what happens with COVID over the next few months, and whether those jobs that got, you know, the companies that couldn't hire people during this period, the restaurants, if they shut down finally, then we're not going to have those jobs come back. So all this put together will be factors that will affect how we recover from this, and hopefully we don't get a very bad situation with COVID down the road.
Is there, Professor, another alternative for some of these places that can't seem to find employees? Is there a point where they just say, listen, either we shut down or we have to pay more, maybe paying more than they ever thought they would have to get some people in the door? I would think there's a fine line there if it cuts into their profitability.
Exactly. So if you want people to pay more to bring people in, just like my mechanic said, well, the one of his workers said, why would I come to earn $15 from you when I can get $25 sitting at home? Then he can't pay $25 to get the jobs done at his shop. He'll have to shut down. So it puts us at a point where, like you said, there's a fine line there. We have to make that decision. Some companies, big companies, big corporations will survive. But the mom and pop, my regular businesses will struggle. And we're hoping that we don't have a lot of problems with COVID going down the road. But if COVID does not come back and hit us so bad, I think we may recover. We may survive this. And we may pay a little more, but not as much as people will expect.
And yet, Professor, I'm reading, and you probably have as well, we have stories over the next couple of days, or the last few days, about a couple of new variants, the Lambda variant, and there's another one. Mm-hmm. And look, I'm no economist like you are, an expert, but I'm saying to myself, you know, how much can a world or a state or a national economy handle before it's permanently crippled? I mean, do we know? Are there any models on that? Or is this just as each day goes?
This is a situation where the world has not gone through anything like this. And like you said, you know, despite the expertise, the learnings that we've had over time, this is one area where you can see for over 18 months, we're still struggling. Even science had some troubles, right? The only thing I'll ask is that if we can quietly take away politics from all this,
sure,
we may have some silver lining down the road. But as long as we have politics involved in this, which is why the U.S. is having the tougher side of this.
And finally, what about the inflation question here, Professor? And you've obviously seen and heard this and talked with your compatriots about this, I would think. The idea of, do you overstimulate the economy because then the inflation word comes in and then you add that to the mix and there's even more doubt here. What do you think of the inflation issue here?
That's actually been a concern of even the best of economists, right? But at this point, I think the word there is what we call rational stimulus. So we're not, you know, like we're not overstimulating the economy. We're not sending things out just to send it. This past few months had shown that it could be a problem if we do that, because one, see how that affected the labor market. And that's going to shrink down the other aspects of our lives.
Yeah.
And the economy, of course, is going to have an impact hit on this whole thing, because if you keep pumping in resources in there, you're going to really have a bad situation down the road. But I think there'll be a moderation somewhere, and I think they're talking about it already.
All right. Quinnipiac University Professor Nelson Alino. He's the Interim Associate Dean of the School of Business. He's also a professor of accounting. Professor Alino, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. We'll check in down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Be good. There you go.